Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition event held in London in November 2023. This session was titled Inspiring Ingredients for Longevity and Healthy Later Life. Our panel discusses how consumers are increasingly seeking to take control of their health span by turning to food and nutrition. They delve into how the food industry is innovating to support these consumers and the ingredients that are leading the way. Your host is the Professor of Exercise and Nutritional Science at the University of Bedfordshire, Robert Thomas.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining this session, and thank you for our panelists. Now, this session is about longevity. So we all want to live to 150, don't we? Show of hands? Nobody? Oh, one. Okay, well, there we are. Well, as you probably know, longevity is not about living till 150. Sorry about that. It's about living, it's not about how not to die. It's about how to live. And how to live, a bit of a dig to my rival in the books there. But anyway, what we don't want is we're all going to have to work for longer because we need to pay more taxes and not retire at 65. So we're all going to have to be working till 75 anyway. So what we want is after, you know, in your twilight years, to be able to enjoy life, to be fit, not to have arthritis, not to have dementia, to be enthusiastic, no fatigue. And this is what this session's about. How can we prepare ourselves so that we can enjoy life, to the full, to your late 80s, early 90s. So I'm delighted to welcome three innovators in their field, probably more on the product side, which is the most important thing. This is, what do we go out and buy, which is going to keep us healthy for longer. So I'll start with Vivian. I've just heard, up until recently, was head of research for Pucker Herbs. We're all familiar with Pucker Herbs. I've got a cupboards full of them. They are a great way to increase your herbal intake, but also they taste nice and they rehydrate. So, this is a fantastic thing. You've done a lot of research on deciding the ingredients for these products and how linking with universities and, the evidence for how they could improve cognition, reduce fatigue, and all sort of chronic illnesses as we get older. So it'd be lovely to hear more from you going forward. So we've got Harriet Smith, who's currently the founder of HRS Communications and was, previously a writer for, many organizations, including Complete Nutrition. The Biox said that you've written 13,000 articles, which means you probably would have had to write them in your sleep. That's been corrected. It was 413, one article research. Anyway, but for that, you did get Writer of the Year in 2018, so well done for that. And you, as a writer myself, you really have to understand what you're writing about. So you're obviously completely knowledgeable in this field. And Claire Hughes is someone, obviously, many of you would be delighted to meet because she decides whether you're going to become successful, amongst other things, of course, because she works as Director of Product Development and Innovation for one of the best supermarkets in the UK, Sainsbury's, and has had over 20 years' experience. And looking at not just, I don't know if you were involved with supplements, but the whole spectrum of foods and household goods. So she's an innovator and she's very, very experienced. So thank you and welcome to this session. So, let's start with a few questions. So I'll start with Claire, I think, on this one. So what do you think consumers are looking for, your average consumer? Well, you answer the question. What are consumers looking for when they come to Sainsbury's and look what's on the shelf?
I think one of the challenges we have, and that is who is your average consumer? And that's one of the challenges of a retailer, actually, because you end up, you want to talk about different ingredients. There's a regulatory component there which doesn't enable you to do that. So you have to be really, you're really restricted about what you can put in pack. So you have to find other ways of doing it. So, I mean, I think if I think about some research I saw yesterday, most consumers are... the first thing that they're really conscious of is price. And that's even if you segment it by your more affluent customers. And then interestingly, which always comes up second, is health. And through the years when I've looked at research, it's moved up a bit. So it's always like, well, what's in it for me? What am I looking for? And then the third thing's really sustainability. So I think when people think about sustainability, they expect people to be making sure the products are as sustainable as they can be. I know that word's used a bit loosely, so it's quite difficult sometimes to understand people understand what we mean by it. But that the products are healthy, and health can mean a very different thing for me to another customer that's in the store. And that's where, when you talk about vitamins and minerals, I actually think it's sometimes easier in supplements because they're really targeted, the claims are clear. Whereas in the food space, there's loads of ingredients that I think are super healthy. It's just difficult to talk about them. Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, Sainsbury's, in my impression, is one of the sort of better supermarkets. Do you think your people who come through your corridors are more aware of foods than, say, if you just go to the local Nissa or blame other supermarket? But, you know, do you think they're a more educated population?
Our customers are more aware of health and more health conscious. Actually, we overtrade in that area, so they are coming in with a health need or a health mindset. But it is that. It's just that whole, what does that mean, and how do you segment people, and how do you help people find the right products and make it simple as well? Because I think there's a tendency to try and put too many messages on pack, and it gets lost. So you have to talk about the food first. It needs to taste great. If you don't deliver on taste, then people won't repeat purchase.
Yeah. Fantastic. Now, Vivian, you, in your bio, you specifically mentioned that you research ways to develop products, and you said respect to nature. What do you mean by that? How do you make sure we're not raping the environment to make nice teas?
Thanks, Robert. That's a tough question. Did I write that? I mean, I've been absolutely honoured to work for Pucker for the last 6 years and have just recently left. And it was a company that was founded on sustainable principles. The founders had intimate friendships with the farmers in India. So, you know, the company very much grew up with that respect to nature, with using organic herbs and spice ingredients. And I think it's a philosophy that we've tried to just follow through everything we do, that, you know, we've got to have this great respect for the planet when we're sort of harvesting tons of curcumin or ginger, for example. So, and I think even the way, I mean, my role has been heading up the clinical research. So I've partnered with many and still partner with many UK universities, and it's finding those sort of like-minded partners as well that are interested in the ethics and what goes on in the supply chains. And we've really managed to have some amazing partnerships along the way. So that's probably what I meant by that, but I can't fully remember what I was going on about.
Does it make it more expensive to develop products which are better for the environment?
Yeah, I don't think it has been in the past. I think we're seeing real problems at the moment through Brexit and getting importing and exporting and moving around the herbs and spices we need to do. I think there has been a premium go on, you know, where we're getting these supplies from. So I think now it's quite noticeable on the shelves, especially in the tea aisle. You've got, you know, some of the organic teas are sort of upwards of about £4 a box now. And so I think that the consumers are noticing that, and they're still buying the tea, because I think a lot of, like you say, they're educated and they know that these are sustainable products, and we particularly want these ones, so that they're happy to pay that. And we've not reduced pack size or done anything like that. But I do think, you know, I'm all for appealing to the mass population. We were talking about inequality yesterday. And so, yeah, when you're upwards of £4 for a box of tea, that can be troublesome for people. So, yeah, we just need to help with that and be mindful of prices can't keep going up forever. But it's challenging times for the industry.
Well, it's still quite cheap, but £4 for a box of tea when it's £3.85 in, you know, for a coffee. So,
anyway. I think so.
Harriet, I think your bio was a bit old. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and where you see, you know, products going in the next couple of years or so?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually a registered dietitian by background, so I come from a nutrition and evidence-based background. I'm also founder of HRS Communications. We are a medical communications agency specializing in nutrition. So we work with food companies right from startups through to blue chip companies. And as a 360 agency, that can be everything from ideation through to content execution. So just remind me of the second question. I'm sorry.
Where's it going in the consumer? What's going to be the next sort of?
Sure.
Maybe not wonder, but where are the trends going?
So from my nutritional perspective and the kinds of conversations we're having with our clients at HRS, my two main messages here, I think, are first of all, back to basics. So I know we're talking a lot about innovation today and exciting trends, but as a dietitian, I think, you know, the focus on ultra-processed foods at the moment is phenomenal, and consumers are becoming increasingly aware of the detrimental impact that can have on health. So what we're seeing is consumers wanting more trust in the process, whether that's scrutinizing ingredients labels, for example, or wanting retailers to be really transparent about why they've put those ingredients into the product and where they're sourced from. Secondly, I think we're also going to see more of a focus on less is more. So moving away from putting lots of additives, preservatives, emulsifiers into products just for the sake of it. And actually, I think there's going to be more of a focus on whole foods, which perhaps up until now haven't been in the spotlight. But I think we cannot forget the plethora of vitamins, minerals, fiber, etc., that foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains bring to our diet. So I'd really like to see the spotlight going back onto those whole foods in 2024.
Brilliant. So maybe a question for Claire. You mentioned about labelling, etc. I mean, one of my biggest bugbears when you want to go and buy a packet of crisps or something, and there's sugar in it. And I know the supermarkets say, whenever we've complained, they've said, oh, that's what consumers want. But they often there's no choice. They've all got sugar in it. So what are you doing as a supermarket to try and reduce hidden, well, you've mentioned additives or preservatives, particularly sugar in your products?
So I don't like the term hidden, actually, because all the ingredients are listed on the back. It's just what I would say is unexpected, probably sugars and products. I'd say that the UK food industry, I'd probably say, is leading in terms of reformulating. If you go outside the UK, I spent a lot of time looking at products in Europe and from the US, they're quite different to what we have here. So there's quite a lot of proactive work being done. And I think when people talk about ready meals or having sugar, I don't think the sugar in crisps, unless they're in there because it's like a barbecue flavour and you need it for the sweetness, but I don't know what's in all the crisps. But if in ready meals and products like that, you would have sugar in the products where you've got like a sweet and sour-based products. I've looked at all those products a lot to see where you can take sugar out. Or if you're using tomatoes, you might put a bit in just to balance the acidity from the tomatoes. But I think the food industry's done a lot, and I'm speaking, I know Sainsbury's have actually, so from an organisation, and to reduce salt as well. I think it gets to a challenge where I'll come back to how you get people and to balance their diet, rather than you can take a lot of salt out of products, but you do get to a point where you compromise the flavour because you would add seasonings and stocks at home to make them. So we do need to get this, how do we help people eat the eat well plate? How do we get people, shift people behaviourally to that way and make it easier? Because I think we can focus on individual foods and they can all have a role to play in a diet, but it comes back to what you said about eating more whole foods and how do we create that 80-20 balance.
Good. I mean, an example, about 10 years ago, I wrote to Tesco's because you couldn't get soya milk without sugar in. And they only said, no sugar. They put a massive sign saying, no, as if that's really weird. You're buying soya milk without sugar. And they said, no, that's what consumers want. Within 5 years, you can't even, it's the other way around. So I just found some supermarkets not a bit slow to do the trends. But anyway, that's my view. So I hope Sainsbury's isn't one of them. So Vivian, you deal with lots and lots of new and quite unusual herbs. I mean, Pukka tea is not just about Earl Grey, is it? So what do you think? Are there any exciting new ingredients out there, like some blueberry from New Zealand or, you know, some Scottish Highland thistle extract or something, which is...
Probably. Oh, where to start? So within our team range, I think we've got over 100 different botanical species. So it makes it a really challenging job, but we do the Camellia sinensis, the amazing green tea and matcha that we heard about this morning, and black tea. Exciting herbs. It's a challenging one. It really is, because there are so many. And actually, I spend all my time delving into the evidence behind herbs. And there's substantial evidence for things like turmeric for arthritis. Cinnamon and all your lovely kitchen spices can help regulate blood sugars and lipids. So rather than looking at individuals, some of the approaches we've taken are actually what are the benefits of drinking 4 or 5 cups a day? You're getting such, you know, Jackie's talking about diversity in plant materials. 4 or 5 cups of herbal tea a day can be delivering you 20, 30 different botanical species. And we've also just done a scoping review looking at the spices you get in your kitchen cupboard, and are those culinary levels good for you? And my colleague Marion, who's presenting at FEN's Nutrition Conference this week, she's reviewed over 150 papers. So actually, when you start looking at the herbal science, there is quite a lot there. And so we've always been passionate about really distilling that down. If I could plug one herb, and actually it's our amazing partners at Exeter University in the sports science department, and they've done a whole program of research now on Asparagus racemosus, which is part of the asparagus family. It's a herb called shatavari from India. And we were talking about yesterday about women's health. And actually do look up Mary O'Leary, Dr. Mary O'Leary's work. They've done amazing work, loads of students in on these projects, and they found that 1 gram of shatavari a day for 6 weeks in postmenopausal women improved muscle strength, improved, turned on genes that support muscle turnover. And so that's a really in-depth study. And linking to Pyrrhal's point this morning about, you know, not just doing science to produce a claim, you know, we're not got that level of investment, but actually bringing in the omic techniques and technologies that you can look at urinary metabolites, so and think about what's going on in the metabolism. So, yeah, my plug for one herb would be to find out and read about shatavari for sure. I think it's got a really exciting future.
And the Pukka herbs, how do they fund? Do they fund the research, or they just look at other people's research? And
I was very lucky when I went in there 6 years ago, and they said, here's a research budget. So we've had about $150,000 a year, which has been amazing. But through that also, I've got, you know, I worked in UK universities, so managing. And I'd say this to any small company, you know, there's a potential to bring in interns and students. It's amazing what you can get done on a low budget. And we've also had like BBSRC and NIHR funding through our partners. So I think I've more or less doubled what the budget was. So I've been very lucky, really, had lots to play with.
Fantastic. Nice to hear. You might get a knock on your door from us. Going on to Harriet, we're talking about you've got some expertise on fortification and organic and clean label, and you obviously write a lot about that, so you must understand it. What would you say the right balance is between those three issues?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And certainly we work with a lot of food and supplement companies at HRS who may come to us before they've even established their product, or perhaps they're further down the line and they have a product and they're looking at how to position that in the market and communicate to consumers. So in terms of fortification, we're all about optimizing the nutritional content of that product versus clean labeling or organic, which I think consumers generally take to mean natural and minimal processing. So Certainly targeted fortification here is important. So looking at your population. So in the UK, for example, we know that there are certain nutrients that are commonly deficient, like vitamin D, for example. So being strategic in how you're tackling that and perhaps looking at the different demographics. So today, obviously, we're talking about healthy aging. So perhaps looking at an older population, what are the nutrients of concern there and how can you address that through your product? I think you have to be careful as a brand not to just put lots of ingredients in for the sake of it, like you were saying, Viv, in terms of the health and nutrition claims that you can make about that product. Consumers are wanting transparency. So there's a big gap, I think, for education of consumers and explaining to them why you've put those nutrients or why you've fortified a product and how that can align with their health and nutrition goals. I think careful of alignment with suppliers is important. So making sure that you're working with reputable suppliers if you're looking for organic ingredients, for example, or even looking to see if you can use natural whole foods as a means of improving the nutritional content of that product. And then finally, certification. So, you know, if it's an organic product, looking at ways you can get that product verified and certified to build that trust with the consumer is important.
Mm. Yes, good. And do you think the public understands certification? Probably the Organic Society, they would understand. Are there any other certified bodies which might appear on the label?
I think that's a great point. And I don't have the answer to that, but I think including consumers in the early market, in the early kind of ideation stage is important. So asking them those questions, does certification matter to you? Mm. What kinds of certifications would you be looking for to make sure that you're really tapping into that? One thing to bear in mind, today, obviously, many of us are from science, nutrition and food backgrounds, and there's a wealth of knowledge in the room. But when you step outside of this room, the average consumer's reading age is about 11 years old, if not lower. So we've got to remember that in terms of how we're educating and speaking to the consumer, making sure that we're translating that information into very easy to understand messages that are accessible to a lay audience is important too.
Mm. I'm sorry to sort of go off track. I mean, we were worried in oncology about iodine deficiency, actually. Now, iodine, as you know, used to be in flour, correct me if I'm wrong, and table salt. You can still buy it in table salt, but it's not added legally. So I'm very worried about iron deficiency. But how do the public feel if they say we've added it as on a population basis? Maybe for yourself. So, you know, do they feel they're being hoodwinked to say, well, you know, there's a big daddy theory that we're all, you know, I might get enough iodine, so why am I having to have it as a fortification? But yet the 90% of the population are heading for deficiency and we're all going to get goiters again. So where's the balance there in fortification?
I think there is a balance because I don't think people know that there's certain products that have already been fortified. So bread and flour is fortified in the UK. I don't think people know that. And they only know because a labelling change in the regulation meant that you had to list it out in the back of packs. So some things that have happened for a long time, people don't know. Although it's broadly accepted in cereals that you have fortification. Mm. I think that in the case of folic acid, and I know that they've been in and out and I've not followed it, but there was lots about whether you fortify the flour or not. And it benefits a large proportion of the population, but not everyone that has the bread. So it's an interesting one because you'll have people that don't want it and maybe it's about choice. The problem is when you give choice, you then don't target all the people that you want because they can choose to opt out. And it actually makes it more complicated for suppliers because if you're handling lots of different flour or an ingredient where you haven't had lots of different nutrients in it, it just adds complexity into that manufacture process. So I think if it's the right thing to do and it comes back to the science, for me, the science has to be there for fortification. Vitamin D, I have done that in a previous role where I fortified a product with vitamin D. We brought it into the bread at a certain level and made sure, and that was done in conjunction with a university looking at the research to make sure it was the right thing and it didn't cause complications. But I think if it needs to come independently and trusted, so I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think vitamin B1 should be in beer?
Vitamin.
That was an Australian innovation where the more beer you had, you're more likely to be vitamin B1. So it's actually a self-fulfilling prophecy. So just put it in the targeted the beer. But never got through. But I thought it was a good idea.
I don't think it'd get through. And you're not allowed to actually answer from a regulation. You wouldn't be able to talk about it. Yeah.
But, okay. Yeah. We'd have to go through Parliament. You think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. So as a researcher myself, we're doing several studies at the moment, one on a phytochemical-rich supplement, one on probiotics with vitamin D added. Where do you think obviously we deal more on symptoms recovering from cancer, so lethargy, joint pains, menopausal symptoms, COVID, preventing COVID. So where do you think we should be looking as researchers? Maybe yourself, Harriet, so because you're on the sort of you write a lot on research. So where should we be concentrating on nutritional research going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think certainly all these non-communicable diseases, like you mentioned, and in fact, I was just speaking to someone earlier outside and they were saying how Alzheimer's is now being described as a new type 3 diabetes. And, you know, there's a lot we can be doing now to hopefully reduce our risk of developing these conditions later in life. So I think, you know, really this piece of education that we talked about earlier and bringing it to the forefront of people's minds that they have this opportunity to potentially reduce their risk of a number of lifestyle diseases through good nutrition and lifestyle is really important. And anything that brands and retailers can do to make that easier and more accessible for everyone is crucial.
So Alzheimer's number one, you said. I mean, that is probably what we're all heading for, isn't it? Or some form of memory or cognitive dysfunction, I think, if we already haven't had it. So on that front, so you are obviously waiting patiently. Should we open up to the audience? There must be some questions. There's a question. Is there a microphone? Are you happy to take questions from you? Yeah, sure you are.
Hello, thank you for a really interesting talk. I've got a question about, I guess, an inspiring ingredient which hasn't been mentioned today yet. It's around, so functional mushrooms, so things like lion's mane, reishi, cordyceps. I guess a question for each of you. So I guess, Vivian, are you doing or do you know of any research out there for the use of functional mushrooms in food products? I guess, Harriet, what claims can be made around those functional mushrooms? And I guess for Claire, do Sainsbury's or have you seen more products coming through that contain those functional mushrooms? If so, what type of products? And also, do you stock any in your supermarkets?
Research first, then. There's an absolute explosion of interest in mushrooms. I'm an enormous fan of a local Bristol company called the Bristol Fungarium, who are organic growers, and they've just sponsored research at University of West of England to start looking at reishi, which is the traditional Chinese longevity elixir mushroom. So massive sort of traditional background around some of these mushrooms as well, and they're looking at Alzheimer's. I think mushrooms have the databases that I create for some of these key herbs like mushrooms are just stuffed full of papers around immune function and the science is coming up all the time. Amazing facts, like we have receptors for mushroom beta glycans on our immune cells. It's like, how does that happen? Things like that just fascinate me. So it just shows how much fungi are an important component of our diets. And that science is all at a really early stage. So watch the space. It's an exciting one.
Yeah, and just to build on that, I think adaptogens and functional foods are really a trend that we should be looking out for next year. People don't want to just eat well. They also want to feel well from the food that they're putting into their bodies. Certainly at HRS, we've seen a rise in clients who are developing caffeine-free coffee alternative products that are using functional mushrooms, for example, as a main ingredient. In terms of the claims territory, obviously it very much depends on the product itself, its ingredient and the quantity of that ingredient, but it would fall under the on-hold botanical claims, which I talked about earlier this morning. Off the top of my head, Viv, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there are some on-hold claims on there, but obviously you have to have, like I said, the right format of that ingredient and the right quantity and meet the conditions of use to be able to use that claim. It's very much an exciting area, and I look forward to seeing the trends next year.
Yeah, so I echo what you both say. I absolutely love mushrooms, and I've been doing loads of work with them over the last few years. I think that we haven't even tapped into what the potential is in the future, not only as a way of treating symptoms from disease potentially when you look at the research there, but also the bit I've been interested in is how you can replace meat, so how you use mushrooms in the diet to replace meat for hybrid products or on their own. They've got a brilliant texture, they give you an amazing flavour, so they've got a sort of umami, natural umami, so they come through. The problem is there's a kind of consumer perception that I don't like mushrooms, so if you tell me there's mushrooms in a product, I'm not going to eat it. And it's how you take that away from, actually, you don't even know there's mushrooms in a product. So I've got quite a lot of mushroom-based, plant-based products in store now. And we're really happy with them, and we'll be working with our suppliers on what's the next generation of mushrooms. But in terms of fungi, I absolutely think for sustainability, sustainable healthy diets in the future as an alternative to meat, they're exceptional. And also we've got, you know, our supplier, we have self-vitamin D enriched mushrooms, but there's such a lot of nutrients that you can get the mushrooms, so you can get the mushrooms to grow and incorporate into the mushrooms, so the consumer's eating the whole food, and then you take that and then you make it into products. So yeah, I think, yeah, love them.
Exciting. Good question. I'm always impressed that mushrooms can generate vitamin D when you expose them to sunlight, so it's probably closer to us than we think.
Yeah, maybe.
So any other questions from the audience? There's a question there.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering about how we connect up the sort of ingredients aspect with the sort of public health aspect, really. And Robert was mentioning this fact that we had fortification for a long time for certain things to prevent certain, you know, public health issues. So if we needed to prioritize according, say, the major public health threats, which are the usual non-communicable diseases, heart attacks, diabetes, obesity, cancer, obviously, wouldn't there be sort of the need to look into certain priority areas with respect to ingredients? I think of, for example, anti-inflammatories, and go about this in a more systematic way with the aim to promote public health more broadly. And then the ingredients would be, you know, the ones we think are good ingredients, for example, to prevent inflammation, which would be reducing a number of diseases and would prevent, you know, increase longevity in the long term.
Excellent question. I think ingredients to reduce inflammation would be tricky, apart from, you know, the colourful foods, making sure people have more of a rainbow diet and good gut health. But are there any, Claire, would you say, is there any sort of foods which would target inflammatory ingredients apart from whole fruit and veg?
I think it's a whole diet approach. Well, it would be for me that would, and I think there are ingredients as part of that, but it'd be quite difficult, I think, to substantiate them on their own, because you'd want the whole, you'd want an anti-inflammatory based diet, which I think is interesting, how you get back to customers to eat that almost 80% of the time. So yeah, I think, I mean, I'm also not only for brain health, I've always been quite an advocate of omega-3, and I've tried to, over the years, failed quite a bit actually to fortify, to get rebalance that in products, but quite often it comes through as a taint and the customer can take it, so they don't buy the product again. But there's a whole, what you were saying about herbs, there's quite a lot of evidence for some of the herbs and anti-inflammatory and how you incorporate them just in meals, I think, in cooking. I'm a fan of that approach.
You have chickens which you've fed omega-3, don't you, to fortify the eggs or not?
Yeah, we do have chickens' eggs that are enriched in omega-3. Mm. Yeah, they do. Omega-3 and vitamin D, you can do them both in, yeah. For the eggs.
Do you want to add anything to anti-inflammatory? Maybe there should be a section in the supermarket, yeah. So free from anti-inflammatory.
I think it's a fine balance between avoiding a singular approach where you're picking out maybe one ingredient that has a claim that you can make that will therefore position the product as being anti-inflammatory. And as I said earlier, it's about going back to basics and perhaps putting the spotlight more on a whole food approach. So really promoting those dietary patterns that we know have anti-inflammatory effects, like the Mediterranean diet, for example, and building that into products that we're selling in retailers. That's not to say that there aren't opportunities in terms of claims with to get into that area. But from my dietetic perspective, I think it's about looking at the bigger picture and the whole dietary approach to anti-inflammatory.
Yeah, just quickly, I think it's interesting when you start thinking about what does the consumer really need, is what you started off talking about, Claire. And at Pucker, we've really clustered all of our education around sleep, stress, you know, the pillars we're talking about yesterday. And if you drew some mad diagram of all these like consumer needs at the bottom, exercise, sleep, and ladder them up, you see they're all risk factors for all the diseases you're talking about. So I think from a public health perspective, you know, really focusing in on these important pillars of reducing stress, you know, menopausal health, sleep, for example, would do a long way. You know, sleep's a risk factor in dementia, of that sort of wartime population where those over 80s haven't never slept for 60 years or whatever. That was my mum. You know, so I think, yeah, it's pulling together the science that's there and drawing lines, I think, would be a really useful thing to do. But it's a lovely question. Thank you.
Yeah, so more about education, maybe educating the customers. Any other questions? There must be there's one over there.
Thank you. I'm just curious, price was mentioned as, you know, a top priority to influence consumers' behavior. Do you think within stakeholders, supermarkets and retailers, that there is a responsibility to consider consumers' the population health and nutrition needs when it comes to point strategies? For example, Sainsbury, you do have Nectar Point prices for different produces. Are the healthy products that, you know, being considered, is that a consideration on those products being pushed for sale?
It is actually, so it's embedded in, because we have a target for healthier sales that we publicly report on as part of our corporate social responsibility commitments. And what we have done through schemes like Nectar, which is an interesting thing when you look at that data and how you can influence behaviour change. We've used that on fruit and veg to look at uptake in fruit and veg and encourage people to purchase and try new things that they probably won't have tried before, because when you look at what people eat, it's quite a small, usually quite small and narrow. They tend to buy the same products. We've put kale and other products into that so that people try them. And then if you look at the sort of campaign we have on price, value in store or price match campaign, about we'd look at 70% of those products would have a really good nutrition profile, which is really high. So it is part of our consideration when we're doing, we don't do 3-for-2 promotions either. And I think that's responsible to think about the customers and put it as part of you. But we've got really, everyone's got those targets embedded within, it's part of our role to deliver our healthier, sustainable diets commitment.
Harriet, on the price side, I mean, it's still very sad. You go into a supermarket anywhere and you see the healthier food's twice the price of the unhealthy. I mean, you can get this lovely product which was developed by the lawyer. Is she here? You know, there were like healthy snacks with cinnamon and turmeric in, but they were £1.70 and you can get a bag of Monster Munches for, you know, for 40p. Mm. So on the research side, would there be any, in your experience, is there a ways people who research food could get better grants from governments to try to develop foods which end up cheaper? Or Vivian, or do, is there access to, I mean, that's what it needs. It needs government intervention, because you can't develop a unique healthy food for 40p a bag.
I think everything we're talking about over the last 2 days and the need for research needs government, it needs research funding. You know, you can't rely on a small company and half the people in the room to fund your own research. I mean, organic is a great example, isn't it? And I think the Soil Association do great work and sponsor literature reviews. But I know there's more work, there's more research out there, but they've not yet summarised it. So we need the research funding and joined up approaches from, you know, everyone in this room really to really address questions like that. But I think organic is a really good case in point.
There is, tips from, sorry,
there is for products, actually, there's some quite good research grants. So Innovate UK do loads of work where if you've got a product to bring to market, you can link up. And a bit further back, there's BBSRC funded research. And there's a new sort of, there was one I was involved in a long time ago, which was about bringing industry and smaller players together so that we could develop end products for the consumer. And they've just got a another round in that. So there is quite a lot of research funding available. So if you're looking for it, I would go through those routes and then find partners.
Yeah. We're actually working with Innovate UK at the moment. And like you said, they've got some amazing projects out there. One thing I would just expand on there, back to basics, like I said earlier. So we know that obviously the cost of living crisis is not going to go away anytime soon, unfortunately. But let's put the spotlight back on fruits and veg, for example. You talked about a packet of crisps being 40p, but you can definitely get a piece of fruit, you know, a simple satsuma or apple, hopefully for under that, from certain places. So let's not forget about the benefits that we can get from eating whole foods as well as composition food products and supplements.
Good point. Right, I've noticed we're 3 minutes late, so we can't take any more questions. So can I ask you to applaud the fantastic panel?
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, I'd like to tell you about Tastes of Better, part of the Food Matters Live event series, where you can experience the latest food innovation firsthand. You'll get to discover value-adding ingredients and meet the technical experts behind them. Explore every element from flavour, texture and mouthfeel to shelf life, nutrition, sustainability and cost efficiency. Check your eligibility and apply for a seat at the table over at foodmatterslive.com.